Stick the kettle on, make yourself a cup of coffee, but don't drink it. Not straight away. Have you ever thought about what really goes into making that cup of coffee happen? Today, we're going to be addressing one very small change you can make in your daily life to, yep, you guessed it, create a positive impact. In today's episode, I'm chatting to Holly Craggiopoulos, one of the founders and CEOs at North Star Coffee, a specialty coffee roaster based in Leeds since 2013. North Star are a company I've had a strong connection with already, and from the day I conceived of this podcast, I knew that I'd have to have them on at some point. Coffee is an industry really close to my heart, and one that most of us come into contact with at some point. So many of us will slam down 4 or 5 cups of instant coffee a day without a second thought. We take it for granted. It's cheap, it's accessible, gets us going, and we certainly don't think for a second that a world might exist where that simply isn't possible anymore. But is that the future we're staring at right now? Before we find out, here's this week's positive news segment. This week, we have some uplifting news from the medical front. Scientists have discovered a promising new approach to treating prostate cancer, particularly for those with advanced forms that resist current therapies. Prostate cancer, as many of you might know, affects over 1 million men globally every year. Whilst many can live for years without symptoms or even needing treatment, there's a subset of patients who find it difficult to battle the disease due to its resistance against drugs. But here's the breakthrough. Researchers have found a way to block the messages that cancer cells send out to take over healthy white blood cells. By doing so, they've managed to reverse resistance to therapy in a small patient group, and in some cases, even shrank or halted tumour growth. These findings were published in the Nature Journal. Leading this charge is Professor Johan de Bono from the Institute of Cancer Research, who believes that this could herald a completely new approach to treating prostate cancer. In a trial they conducted, a mix of an experimental drug and a common hormone therapy was given to patients. A notable 24% of them showed significant positive responses, with tumour reductions and a drop in markers often elevated by cancer. What's even more promising is the broader implications of this research. The same cells they're targeting might be involved in resistance in various cancers, so this could be a game changer across multiple cancer types. The efforts were backed by multiple organisations, including Prostate Cancer UK and Cancer Research UK. Dr. Matthew Hobbs from Prostate Cancer UK expressed immense excitement, hoping that this research will soon transform into real, effective treatments for men around the world. So fingers crossed, and here's to more breakthroughs and positive strides in the world of medical science. Let's dive into today's chat and see what we can all do in our daily lives to make a huge impact on the livelihoods of families across the world. I imagine for many of us, our morning routine may well involve getting up in the morning, mm-hmm. We come downstairs with our dressing gown on, a bit bleary-eyed, and we put a teaspoon of instant coffee in a cup, some boiling water, maybe some milk and sugar, and we call it job done. So what's the problem with that?
It's a really good question, and absolutely not a problem from a kind of personal preference point of view. If you just prefer instant coffee, then yeah, there's no problem with that. It's super quick, super convenient. I think instant coffee presents a slight problem for the sustainability of the industry, because it was very much tied with coffee becoming a commodity. And really, as soon as something that's essentially farmed by around 120 million families around the world becomes a commodity, it means that the consumer becomes detached from the producer at the start of the supply chain. And I think what instant coffee does is it don't get me wrong, it means that lots of us have easy access to caffeine on the morning, which is, like you pointed out, very necessary, but it can really stop the thought process at that cup, really. As soon as you put that coffee in your cup, you're not transported to thinking about where the coffee came from, to thinking how those farmers were paid, how they're looked after as a result of the kind of your purchase of that instant coffee. And so I think the slight issue with it is it's created a scenario where we've all become a little bit detached from the very human impact of coffee purchasing and coffee roasting, really. And that's kind of, I guess, our whole ethos as a company is how do we connect consumer to producer once more? Because like you say, so many of us rely upon a cup of coffee to start our day, whether it's, yeah, first thing in the morning or that mid-afternoon slump or even after dinner. And it would be really, really awful if that coffee became hard to get hold of purely because it was no longer a viable kind of business opportunity for those that we're reliant upon the most at the start of the supply chain.
And is that what we're staring at then? If sort of looking forwards, if maybe we don't change our relationship and understanding to who's involved in the mm-hmm. supply chain and the work they do, the farmers, the growers, mm-hmm. are we at risk of losing that, of not having something that we kind of take for granted first thing mm. in the morning?
Yeah, it sounds extreme, but when you throw in climate change into the mix as well, which is posing a huge environmental risk for the areas that grow coffee, which is exclusively between the tropics, so the areas that are already most impacted by the impact by the effects of climate change. Coffee as a species is very genetically not diverse, so is very kind of at risk for possible large scale wipeout due to changes in weather patterns and pests and diseases that come into the mix. But the social side of it, with coffee being set up really in colonialism as a non-native crop to most of the countries that it grows in and established on models of essentially slave labour, essentially that whole purchase cycle of coffee beans from producers getting it into mostly European or American roast houses has never ever worked for the producer and has created a situation where there's immense power imbalance. And we've now got a scenario where the average age of the coffee producer is between 55 and 57, with many just uprooting coffee to plant maize or avocado or, in the worst cases, cocaine, like a crop that's more lucrative, that's actually going to be able to put food on their family's tables and send their kids to school. So we are in a scenario, not to sound too doomy, too much doom and gloom about it, but we are in a scenario where we're facing a very real possibility that coffee may as a crop die out, partly because of climate change and partly because we are going to run out of people who will grow and harvest it.
I mean, that is quite remarkable. And I, you just don't, you don't think about it. I mean, I maybe do a little bit more than most, but you just kind of assume it's always going to be there, don't you? Because it's been mm-hmm. so abundant, and you just, I guess we take it for granted. And mm-hmm. so where then does speciality coffee as an industry fit into this? How does it, what makes it different, and how is it trying to combat some of these issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think speciality coffee, first of all, to define it, it's an actually recognized grade of coffee, which sort of refers to around 5% of total world production in the whole world. And that 5% is essentially graded to be speciality grade based on characteristics like sweetness and aftertaste, acidity, body, flavour, cleanliness, uniformity. And all of those attributes are scored out of 10 to give a score of over 80 out of 100 if it's going to be speciality grade. So it's not kind of like saying artisan or gourmet, which are kind of fairly ambiguous terms without a universal definition. Speciality grade is actually an industry recognised term that's obviously transitioned into the sort of coffee shop space and is more understood now by the consumer. And really what speciality has done is essentially like broken down some of the barriers between producer and consumer through quality. So it's kind of, it's absolutely not the answer. It's not the kind of answer to safeguarding the entire industry. But the reason that I, for instance, know about this big problem is because if we can give our consumers, the people who buy from North Star, a cup of coffee that's extraordinary, that really sort of stands above the likes of what you'd get from a pot of instant or even on the high street in a chain, we've found such an amazing success rate with having that consumer then need to know, why does this taste so different and so much better than what I've had before? And that's our kind of door opener, really, to having the conversation I've started to have with you, which we do not ram down everybody's throats in our coffee shops or our wholesale customers. But it's become very successful in just connecting the consumer to the producer in a manner that's as simple as them enjoying a cup of coffee and actually thinking about it, because they can't fail not to when you're drinking something that tastes so extraordinary.
I wonder whether you'd be able to share, you've been in this for is it 10 years now? You said 2013, didn't you? So 10-year birthday. Congratulations. Yeah. That's quite impressive by itself.
Yeah.
I wonder whether, yeah, you'd be able to share some success stories, and maybe we can look at directly what positive impact this has had. I know that you're keen to highlight growers and producers and people. So perhaps maybe you can share, yeah, some projects that you've been involved in where you can point to that and say, we did a good thing here. This is a vast improvement, and we've taken a big leap forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're often a bit shy about shouting about these things because we're very acknowledging of how tiny we are as a company, particularly in a global commodified supply chain. But what we have done is really tuned into the role that we can play within the supply chain. And we made a decision when we started the company that we wanted that role to be one that contributed something positive rather than just participated in the status quo. So we've definitely had the ability and the sort of dynamism in a way to actually kind of question the way things have always been done and explore if there's another way of working that will bring about a better outcome, not just for the producer, but for the longevity of our business. This isn't us kind of essentially just trying to be martyrs or saints. It's very much something we looked at and thought, well, if we want a business in 30 years time, how do we need to actually be working in the day to day to ensure that we're going to have great supplied coffee in that period of time? So, yeah, for the first sort of, I guess, 4 years of North Star, we spent a long time really fine tuning the offer list of what we actually purchased, ensuring that every coffee on there essentially was there for a really valid reason, be that assisting marginalized producers get access to a market that they'd traditionally been kept out of, whether it was specifically working with women producers to try and address some of the gender inequality that happens in the coffee industry. And when we kind of got to a point where we were buying more impactful volume from producers, that it was at that point where we really started to question, how do we support beyond just the purchase contract? So beyond the fact that we, for instance, detach ourselves from the stock market price that's given to coffee. So most coffee in the world is traded on something called the C market, which is just a price that's based on supply and demand globally, which means a producer in Ethiopia might receive a price that has nothing to do with the costs involved in producing that coffee or the quality, but is just because Brazil produced a surplus supply that year. So that tends to be how the transaction happens. The way that we work is completely outside of that. So we sort of look at quality, you know, first and foremost, and ensure that differentials are paid on the basis of acknowledging the quality, but also to guarantee those costs of production have been covered, because we base our entire model on trying to create viable business models. And I think the first definition of a viable business is one that's profitable. So beyond the purchase contract, we started to question how we could supplement that support with investment in projects, specifically within the supply partnerships that we had built over the last few years. So we've managed to sort of successfully implement two so far, and they've been fairly tiny in terms of their reach, but the impact has been really deep and kind of long term, I suppose. So I'll try and be as brief as possible in talking through them. But the first one we did was with a female producer called Maria in El Salvador, who was essentially, she was without any processing infrastructure. So she had a beautiful farm called Finca Margarita, but she was unable to actually get the beans out of the cherries. All she could do was pick the cherry and then basically receive a price for the cherry, which is at that point nowhere near close to being an exportable, valuable product. So she was having to sell the cherry to her neighbours to pay them to process the coffee for her, and was essentially kind of being denied a massive portion of that final price being paid. So what we did was we invested around about $10,000 to help build drying infrastructure and fermentation tanks, investing in things like moisture meters and colour meters and things like that, so that she could take real ownership over the entire process from harvesting to preparation for export, and therefore open up the entire chunk of money that was being paid that she could access. And not only has that kind of created a business that she now is actually going to be able to pass down to her children, but we're also able to access her coffee as an exclusive micro lot for North Star, because beforehand it was all having to be blended with her neighbor's lots. We'd never had direct traceability to Finca Margarita. And that lot, we're actually about to showcase at a coffee shop in London called Roslyn towards the end of November. And we're able to sort of access those sorts of opportunities because we now have this world exclusive Pacamara micro lot that we only access because of that investment. So that was pretty huge and something that has been mutually beneficial. And the second one is we've invested in a youth project in Rwanda. So we've worked with the Chiato washing station in Nyungwe for about 4 years now and started to ask the question, what are the problems you're facing in the area? And the biggest one that sort of stood out was that young people were being forced to move out of their home village because there was no land available for them to kind of start coffee farming. There were no opportunities locally other than working in mining. So lots of them were either working in the mining industry or moving to Kigali or emigrating abroad. So what we did was we sponsored the preparation of 8 hectares of land, which we've planted with 20,000 coffee trees. And they've been distributed amongst 20 young people who are supporting with agronomy training and harvesting support, organic compost. And we're expecting the first crop from those seedlings next summer, which we'll be buying automatically in a manner that guarantees profitability with a relationship that's based on trust and mutual respect. So that's kind of, it might not be that all 20 of those producers end up sticking with coffee, but if we can help with some of them, then hopefully we've had some impact in creating the next generation of coffee producers in that area.
Absolutely. And I'm being honest, I have tried the Finca Margarita and it is absolutely delicious. So anyone that's looking to get into coffee, doesn't know where to start and is perhaps looking at the North Star website, that is definitely a good place to begin. Shout out to Jack at Quarters Coffee in Newport for introducing me to that. No, that's great. I mean, it's really nice to hear the real stories kind of on the ground, what's actually happening here. And that, when you put it into perspective of people and their livelihoods, I think that you start to draw some new connections there, mm-hmm. as opposed to just the powder that you put in your cup at the end. There are real lives, families, livelihoods at stake with this. Yeah. It's a big industry. I'm just wondering, is it the case, because obviously when you look at commodity grade coffee or the coffee you buy in the supermarket mm-hmm. versus specialty, there is a big price difference and we are going to come on to that more. I'm just wondering, is it the case that there are, let's say in the commodity coffee supply chain, there are certain players in that chain that are hoarding the money and it's not being shared evenly? Or is it just that the price is so low, there's not really enough to go around and look after the farmers? Is that...
No, it's definitely the case that there's a disproportionate amount of the value that's being retained by the likes of Nestle and those Kraft, those kind of big companies that really run the whole industry in terms of the volume of coffee that they buy and the buying power that they have. This isn't to say that every kind of commodity buyer or roaster or brand of instant coffee is directly sort of creating a scenario where farmers are in poverty and not being paid a living wage. There are some cases where costs of producing commodity grade coffee are very low. There's, not to get too technical, but the bulk of it is a species called Robusta, which grows at sea level. It requires next to no inputs. It kind of grows like wildfire, is very, very high yielding and is therefore much cheaper to grow as opposed to specialty grade, which tends to be Arabica growing at really high altitudes on kind of terroir that's very steep and uneven and requires lots of labour to actually pick the coffee and kind of move through it. So it's not quite as clear cut, I guess, as I think we're always searching for how to sort of simply explain what's going on and like just tell me what the right thing to do is, because there's just so many things to take into account. And it's absolutely not the case. Speciality has its downsides in the fact that producers don't just have farms that produce 100% speciality grade coffee. Producers will have a kind of offshoot of the bulk of their crop that's achieved that grade, but then what do they do with the rest of it? And if you're an exclusive specialty buyer, you can't always kind of support the producer with the full volume purchases as you'd maybe like to. So there's definitely ups and downs to both sides of things. I guess what I tend to see from the sort of specialty market is that because we have a much more engaged coffee consumer base, we're being asked questions by our customers that we then have to ask of our suppliers. And that doesn't happen. That interaction doesn't happen when it's instant coffee. The expectation just isn't there. And the thought to even ask the question a lot of the time doesn't exist. So I think what speciality does do for the industry is it definitely pushes it forwards and knocks on doors that have maybe not been knocked on before.
Let's talk about the money side of things a little bit more. This is where I think things, especially right now, get very interesting. If you were to look at a bag of coffee on let's say North Star's website or another specialty roaster versus something in a supermarket, there is a big price difference there. And I think, to be honest, a lot of the reasons why you have kind of spoken to already. But even amongst yourselves and other specialty roasters, there's been price changes. You've announced some price changes recently. Prices are going to be going up. So are you able to explain a little bit more about what's going on economically, both for yourselves, for the industry at large, to what's causing these price changes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it would make sense to start at origin, at source, to sort of, I guess, put across like how that sort of cascades down the supply chain. And really for years, the first factor is we've been paying too little for coffee for hundreds of years because of how it was set up as a kind of a model and an industry, really. And we've kind of been just starting to slowly see that being challenged by producers over the last few years and really kind of getting an understanding as to what a profitable price truly is. So there's that sort of context there. But the actual kind of reality was that in 2020, first of all, we had the pandemic, and obviously everybody knows about the challenges with logistic costs, getting hold of a shipping container to get coffee from out of Burundi to into the UK was super challenging and very, very expensive. So that was a whole thing, and there's been knock-on impacts there. In 2021, Brazil had a black frost, which obliterated around 70% of yield on some of the farms in Brazil. And Brazil's the world's largest coffee producer. So that obviously had a huge impact on the sea market, on the world price, because supply suddenly was, in some cases, 70% down on what it had been in previous years. And that the difference between a black frost and a normal frost really is that the black frost kills the tree, so that it's not kind of like just that year's harvest that's affected, but it's potentially 3-4 years out as well. So, and that's kind of what we're feeling now is it's kind of pushed everything up in response to this sort of global panic that there's not going to be enough coffee in the world. There is, but it's just the market did some very, very interesting things. We've also had the war happening, which has had a real impact on access to fertilizer, obviously, in coffee producing countries. That's been a huge consideration as well. So there's been a whole host of things that have happened within our supply chain network. If I bring that a little closer to home and look at the other suppliers that North Star works with, everything's gone up across the board, whether it's packaging, in terms of the actual coffee bags, the logistics of shipping anything, cardboard prices, postage prices, everything. We've had our energy bills rise by 5 times. We've had our staff costs sort of rise by between 10 and 12% with inflation, the inflation that we've all experienced. So we just got to a very clear point where we've kind of held off. In all honesty, we've just not looked too closely at what's actually been going on with our bottom line, which sounds quite irresponsible as a business owner, but it was something that we didn't want to be too reactive with. Last year, I think when everything was kind of becoming quite scary, it could have been really tempting to initiate this increase at that point. But we just honestly couldn't get a sense of how long term these things were going to be, whether there was going to be any further government support or initiatives to help fight the energy crisis and the inflationary cost that we were facing. And obviously we're now kind of a year on, having just watched our profitability dip and dip and dip. And we were at a point where we were sort of saying, well, we are going to have to make a decision soon about, you know, how we're purchasing our coffee. Well, that's non-negotiable. That's something that it would no longer be a business we'd want to even run if we were kind of messing too closely with that. Or we were going to have to completely change the business model, potentially reduce staff wages, either through like moving away from our commitment to be a living wage employer or actually cutting numbers in the team. And again, that wasn't something that we wanted to do. Don't get me wrong, if we'd have had to have made that decision, we'd have had to have made it. The kind of, we've got a kind of higher purpose, I guess, that we're responsible for. But yeah, that was where we'd got to. And it's very similar with lots of businesses, not just in coffee. Of course, I think everybody's been hit with those awful emails. We had to send one out a couple of weeks ago to communicate that the prices were going to be going up. And yeah, it's just the world that we now live in, unfortunately.
Yeah, it reminds me of of a question I was asked years and years ago in relation actually to food, but you know, sort of fresh high quality produce versus cheap frozen things. And I think the question that's often asked is why is it so expensive? And actually the better question to ask is why is the other stuff so cheap? Because
yeah.
you've got all these factors at play. It makes total sense why the price is going up, as you've clearly explained. So how, it's not a case of why is it more, it's how is Monte Coffee so cheap that comes at a cost, and often hidden costs. And I think it's nice to, maybe not nice, but it's important to shine a light on actually really what's going on there and who's being exploited in that process. Someone's paying that price difference, right? And often it's not the consumer, which I guess the big brands are very good at molding to their their business models. Especially coffee is, again, I suppose not too far away from the money side of things, but on a more interesting sort of geeky point of view, it can become quite a rabbit hole, right? Once you start getting into it and you get into the gear and the tech and the science, and then before you know it, you're going to discover James Hoffman on YouTube, and he's going to rope you in and convince you that coffee is the greatest thing in the world, and he's right. And so I mean,
we've all been there, Sam.
And to be honest, anyone who hasn't, absolutely go check out James. He's brilliant, and he'll get you into coffee. He'll get you buying good coffee, which I think is important. But with that in mind, can be quite daunting. So where would you recommend that someone starts? Someone that hasn't really got into specialty before, they're looking to make that switch. What's the easiest way they can do that?
I think, you raise such a good point, because it's a factor in the industry that's absolutely pushed it to what it is right now and created it into the industry that it is. But it is also massively exclusionary and quite scary, I think, if you're on the outside of it, sort of wondering where to start. And I'm going to admit that my favourite brew method is a French press. And I can guarantee most people, whether they have instant or are maybe having freshly ground coffee from the supermarket right now, that's probably the first thing that they might find in the back of the cupboard somewhere. And it makes a cracking coffee if you know what to do with it. Like, you really can get amazing results from that. So don't kind of be thinking, I need to spend thousands of pounds on this incredible sort of space-like looking grinder and this amazing sort of coffee machine. It doesn't have to, you don't have to go down that road. And there's definitely a sort of a step-by-step, I would say, that's really important to move through to actually sort of become an informed enough consumer so that you can really, really understand the language and the vocabulary and sort of get your head around it, in all honesty. And I think the most kind of frustrating scenario we come across is when people tell us they don't like coffee, because I just refuse to accept that. not because I love it so much, but because I just feel like they've not had the right coffee for them. I think if I get that some people genuinely like don't like the smell or whatever, but when you consider that most people's first interactions with coffee, myself included, would be instant coffee from a jar, maybe something from a ropey service station or any of those high street chains, a lot of the time you wouldn't be blamed for responding with kind of a look of horror on your face as you take the first sip, particularly if you've not added milk or sugar to something that is really quite dark and bitter and really difficult to drink. And that is generally our first introduction into coffee. But when it comes to obviously speciality, you've just got such an array of different profiles, completely dependent on the terroir, the kind of process that coffee's been through. That, let's say you prefer tea. We have some coffees on our range that are more tea-like than coffee. Really light-bodied, very, very sweet, floral notes, citrus notes. And to that kind of drinker, that would be exactly what I would be getting them to try first and foremost. Obviously, we've kind of got a bit of a bad rep in the specialty industry for being coffee snobs, which of course we all are. Like, we all really care about the coffee that we drink. But you have those tasting notes, and I think there's a lot of disbelief. Some people, like, can you really taste? I mean, the one I've got in front of me is blood orange, black tea and butter in our Burundi. And like, yes, you absolutely can. Once you kind of understand the attributes that we're sort of exploring to deliver those tasting notes. And I've been kind of, it's been a really joyful thing to witness. The first time you give somebody that coffee, that's like the one where they went, oh, I never believed you could taste blueberry in coffee, and I now taste it. I get it. It's a really amazing thing to witness. So I think my advice would be to not be too put off, like start simple. First question I ask someone is, do you prefer your coffee with or without milk? Because that kind of excludes some coffees from that, depending on the answer that you give. Prefer your coffee with milk? Then I would then ask, do you want to try something quite chocolatey and sweet, or do you want to explore something slightly fruitier and more contemporary? And it's as simple as that. That kind of interaction can happen, and we can get you a coffee that you're guaranteed to really enjoy, that's going to fit your kind of flavour profile preference. We split our range into the kind of base and explore coffees, with our base coffees being those more traditional coffee tasting coffees that still have bags of character, so much natural sweetness, minimal bitterness, but are ultimately going to be real crowd pleaser coffees that are the best place to start if you're kind of just at the start of your journey in speciality. And then you can really kind of explore the range, sort of taking one step further into the more bonkers, crazy coffees, the other end of the range, as your palate kind of gets used to them. And as you kind of challenge yourself with what coffee should taste like, and the fact that sometimes coffee doesn't taste like coffee at all, but it tastes like Skittles or, you know, something totally, unexpected. But it can all start in a cafetiere. And that's what I would say.
There's something quite funny there to me. You're talking about cafetiere and the simplicity of it. And for anyone watching this, if you look behind Holly right now, you see where it can go.
Yeah.
all of the grinders and the gadgets and the machines.
To just say though, my home setup does not look like this. I am in our lab at the moment, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. You know what actually else is behind you that I'm wondering might be worth talking about? Is, just remind me the name of it. Is it the SCAA flavor?
Yeah, the flavor wheel.
That, I wonder actually whether it's something that's quite interesting to show people that haven't really got into specialty before, because you might get an idea of just how the range of flavors that can start to appear in coffee. So for anyone that hasn't seen that, I think that might be worth a little look. It might be a bit daunting, but it is very interesting nonetheless.
Well, yeah, and this is just to say, like, this is our cupping lab. So you don't necessarily kind of interact with that kind of resource if you're a consumer and just getting into it. But it's something that we use internally to get to those flavor notes, basically, when we're tasting coffees and really figuring out what's going on in there. With that, we use that wheel. We literally start off with, is this coffee fruity or is it sugary or kind of chocolatey? If it is fruity, does it taste of citrus fruit, or is it more like berries or stone fruit or tropical fruit? And obviously then you get to the outer circle where there's the specific reference, and that's kind of how it's used, basically.
I don't know how you feel about this, but I always really like the comparison to wine, right? Like, yes, you get red and white wine, fine, but it's a big, big wide world once you start getting into it, and there's so much nuance and intricacy, and the flavor profiles are kind of crazy. But where those similarities end is, you buy a bottle of wine, you open it, you taste it, then you know do you like it or not, and all those flavors happen. With coffee, you've actually got some control in that, right? Like, once you buy a bag, yes, it's got flavor notes on it, but there's so many different things you could be doing with it, and you can push and pull it in different directions. I just find that really, really fascinating.
Well, and that's it. That's how you do get sort of hooked into that more geeky kind of side of coffee, and kind of really want to understand the tech available that can bring out a particular flavor note or something that's going to help you refine your process. And I think the other main differentiator between coffee and wine is that with wine, we're all so used to paying more for a better bottle of wine. In coffee, if you were to walk into a specialty coffee shop, the amount of people that come into our coffee shop and balk at the pricing, even though it's cheaper actually than what's available at the likes of Starbucks, it's just the cup size is smaller. We're giving you less milk so that you can taste the coffee more. And it's so hard and frustrating because we can't explain to someone really, really simply how much extra value is in that cup of coffee that they're buying. And yet we are selling it for a cheaper price than Starbucks. And that is ultimately the kind of perception that really genuinely needs to change if we are going to kind of safeguard the industry's future.
Absolutely, yeah. And on the future, as we start to look forward now, what's on the horizon for North Star, for the industry? Where's all this going for you guys?
It's a really good question. It's one we've kind of reflected on just as we've turned 10 years old, because that's been a huge milestone we've reached and never, in all honesty, didn't necessarily expect to. we started the business when we were 23. So it was kind of, we didn't honestly think there'd be a team of people at North Star or like multiple sites or multiple customers serving our coffee. We kind of just had this one guiding vision. And it was myself and my husband that set it up. And then here we are sort of 10 years down the road thinking, okay, well, now we've kind of achieved some of that. Like, we've had to sort of say what's next and yeah, what else, how does the business feel in comparison to what we had in mind when we started? And I think we've kind of got an even bigger challenge on our hands, not just for the kind of guiding mission of the company, but also for the fact we do have an amazing team of people that work here who are relying upon us to guide that next stage of growth and sort of carve out future career progression and all of that. It's a responsibility that we hold really seriously on our shoulders, in all honesty. And I think where we're at is we're wanting to sort of continuously test out our theory around how we do build a coffee industry that works for everybody, because we absolutely haven't got all the answers or kind of have an approach nailed. And I think what we're wanting to do now is actually get some data and sort of testing happening to really sort of put to test our sort of thoughts around like our approach and what the impact's been. And I think in the future, to ultimately help other businesses go down that same road. I think that's kind of where we're at, really. We've not got any kind of grand designs of becoming the next Starbucks or anything like that and going for world domination. I think we're really just here for a good time and to kind of really try and, I don't know, it's a funny phrase I just used, but I guess I'm trying to bring back a little bit of lightheartedness into what's quite a serious and deep issue that we're embroiled in daily. But we're really just looking to continue working with good people, making amazing products and bringing a moment of joy to our customers where possible. And if we can do that and have positive impact on everybody in that supply chain in the meantime, then that would feel really successful to us.
Just remind me what's on the printed on the bottom of your bags. There's a slogan that I very liked. I can't remember the exact wording of it. Is it?
Well, I think we've changed it now. I'm just looking at the bottom of our bag now and there's nothing on there. But
oh, okay. Was it something about we exist to prove that business can exist for good or something like that?
Exactly. It's like we exist to prove you can run business in a car. It was about being kind, really. And then,
And I think when I read it at first, I was actually struck by, it wasn't specifically about coffee, it was about business. So I kind of wanted to ask you, do you see yourselves stretching your influence and what you do and the way you do things into other industries? Because I think you could draw parallels. I think fashion has similar kind of issues, obviously parts of the food supply chain. Mm-hmm. I think you could probably draw some similarities. So mm-hmm. Yeah, do you have kind of ambitions to start to influence other industries with the way that you operate?
I would say we've definitely got ambitions to learn from other industries where possible. We have started to interact with other industries. I think given the kind of deal of focus that we've put on this part of running a business, we've kind of naturally we've entered into a community of other like-minded businesses from other industries. And yeah, I guess it's difficult. Sometimes you can, within those communities, you feel like you're preaching to the converted in a way, because you're speaking to people who absolutely share the same kind of mindset and are doing similarly amazing things within their own space. And I guess like if we got it to a point where we could throw real sort of data behind it and really kind of, and what I'm referring to is we've actually kind of written our business strategy based on our impact strategy. So we've developed something called a theory of change, which is generally more commonly used in sort of charity or non-profit sector. And I suppose what we're trying to do is prove that a for-profit business can absolutely operate with impact as a priority and still make profit and kind of really carve out a blueprint for truly sustainable business in the future. So I suppose, yeah, it's not something we'd be closed off to at all. I don't know if we're still doing anything particularly radical at the moment that other people can necessarily sort of learn from. I guess we'll find out as we go and as we kind of start putting things to the test. I think what we're trying to do is just say, look, we are a small business, and we've managed to put our money where our mouth is on several occasions, whether it was those projects or we became the first coffee company in the UK in 2021 to have home compostable packaging. And those things have kind of, I think if we'd have had a business advisor or a financial director or anybody, I guess, that we were answerable to, that we had to run those decisions by, there's not a lot about them that make business sense at that, in that moment. The project with Maria, for instance, we invested in her infrastructure, and as a result we now have to pay her more for her coffee than we did before because the coffee's so much better. She's improved the quality. So I think that's the first question we're asked by people when I've told that story in the past. People have gone, oh, so do you sort of now like own that farm, or do you have some sort of like stake in the farm? And I was like, no, she could absolutely sell her coffee to anybody. Like, we don't even have priority kind of access to it, really. And that's not the reason that we did it. And then when you kind of say that, people are a bit like, oh, like, what? Why? And I think that's kind of what we're trying to do, is just say, yeah, you don't, let's like stop considering these things purely from the perspective of how is this going to benefit me, and actually like look at it of how is this going to create a business that's here for the long term.
And is there any other product launches that we should be looking forward to? And it mentions Rwanda, and we're sort of running up to the Christmas season now. I understand that's normally time to bring something new and exciting out. What have you got for us this year?
Are you referring to our festive blend, Sam?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think that's always the one that people are most excited about at this time of year. It's become a kind of a firm tradition across lots of kind of Christmas tables, which is amazing for us. We've done it literally since we started. So that will be launching on the 1st of November. So yeah, it's a pretty exciting launch for us. And yeah, generally sees the sort of start of just crazy season in the roastery, because we can't kind of keep up with people taking it off the shelves, which is amazing. So yeah.
Well, that's definitely a good thing. The last thing that we like to do on this show is just to give you an opportunity to give someone a shout out, someone that you think is doing some really great work in the world, someone that's really creating a positive impact, whether that be related to your industry or not at all, a personal friend, a relative, someone you don't actually know but you look up to, absolutely anyone that you think is worth shining a light on for the great work that they're doing.
I mean, this is it. Yeah, it's quite a tough question, really, because there are just so many people I could kind of talk about, but I think the one that comes to mind, and we've not really had too much of an interaction with them up until now, but it's would be probably Hisby, which is they term themselves as like a rebel supermarket, and I'm pretty sure they're only active in Brighton right now, but they came on my radar through, I think, when I was going through the B Corp application process, which we achieved last year. And they're just sort of challenging that normal supermarket model around food and pricing and suppliers and those sorts of things, basically. So it's kind of hard to explain, but I just wanted to name them, I suppose, because I'm desperate for them to open in Leeds.
I've not heard of them before. Hisby. I've not heard of them at all. I'm going down to Brighton soon, I think, so I might have to stop in and see what's going on. Well, we'll definitely have links to Hisby in the show notes for everyone listening.
Yeah,
Holly, thank you so much. That's been amazing. I knew I was going to enjoy that. I'm a big coffee fan. And I hope that listening to you, some of you guys listening at home, maybe that's going to help you take the plunge from switching over from instant to something a little bit more special, a bit more purpose driven, and even, you know, understanding that, yeah, this is a very real, there's real families and lives and people behind this product, and there are ways you can help support that. You can make that better purchasing decision, and you'll actively be contributing to that. Thank you so much for your time, and look after yourself.
Thanks so much, Sam.
So there we go. Ditch the Nescafe Gold Blend and get yourself some good quality beans from amazing roasters like North Star. Now, let me be clear. I am aware that I'm making that decision sound really easy and accessible to everyone. It isn't. Budgets vary, and being able to pay the premium that specialty beans cost is a luxury. And not everyone can do that, especially in these times. I totally get that. And actually, that's a problem in itself. I would just remind you that it isn't a question of why it's so expensive, but it's why instant coffee, commodity coffee, is so cheap. Again, a big congratulations to North Star for 10 years in business. It's been a very tough 10 years in general, so hats off to them for that. You can, of course, find out more about them, their range of coffee. That's all on their website. Links to that is in the show notes. They also have loads of great information about how to start getting more out of coffee and really welcoming you into that world. Today's shout out from Holly went to Hisby, a rebellious supermarket based in Brighton and Worthing. From what I can see, they're looking to completely revolutionise the way that we buy our groceries in supermarkets. I've not been there myself, but from having checked them out, it looks very, very promising. So a link to their website will be in the show notes as well. And let me know if this is something that you've ever thought about before, or in fact, if you've never heard of specialty coffee before and didn't know about the hidden impacts and costs of commodity coffee. I am admittedly a coffee snob, and I have tried to make this episode as accessible as I can. But if I lost you with any of the terminology or anything too geeky, I do apologise. I try my best. And I'll just leave you with this. The next time that you sit down for a coffee, by yourself or with a friend, just take a moment. Smell the aromas. Think about all of the hands it's been through, all of the processes and the miles it's travelled. Think about the journey a single bean has been on to make your cup happen. I find that a great way to bring some perspective and gratefulness to my day every morning.